This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
President Bush and America's challenge in Asia. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Bush was talking tough today about North Korea and nuclear weapons, just one of the many issues he faces in Asia. In South Korea, he'll talk about trade and bird flu with other national leaders. Then it's on to China, the region's emerging superpower. On To the Point, we'll talk about China's rapid economic and military expansion. Is it a threat to Japan or the United States? What about America's so-called one-China policy when it's also pledged to defend Taiwan? On Reporter's Notebook later on, what did Bob Woodward know and when did he know it? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. President Bush has gone from Japan to South Korea, but his biggest challenge in Asia is China. On To the Point, we'll hear about China's economic and military expansion. What does it mean to America's allies and to the U.S. itself? On Reporter's Notebook, Bob Woodward protected Deep Throat for 30 years. Who's he protecting now? First, this news update. A senior member of Congress has called for the immediate withdrawal of American troops from Iraq. Pennsylvania Democrat John Murtha is a Marine veteran of the Vietnam War who's been in Congress for 30 years.
The war in Iraq is not going as advertised. It's a flawed policy wrapped in illusion. The American public is way ahead of the members of Congress. The United States and coalition troops have done all they can in Iraq, but it's time for a change in direction. Our military is suffering. The future of our country is at risk.
John Murtha, Democrat from Pennsylvania. Aaron Billings is a reporter for Roll Call, a newspaper that covers the Congress. And Aaron, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Is John Murtha the kind of liberal Democrat that you would expect to be anti-war?
No. In fact, he is viewed as a defense hawk. He is a defense hawk. He is one of those members that centrists and moderates look to when charting the policies and the message that they pursue as members of Congress and also the Democratic Party as a whole.
When he says, as we just heard him say, our military is suffering, does that suggest that he may be speaking for people in the military in addition to himself?
Well, as you know, he is a veteran. He is a Vietnam veteran, a former Marine. He noted today that he has been spending time with soldiers who have returned from Iraq pretty much on a weekly basis, going to visit them in the hospital. And so I think he was relaying to the public and his colleagues that he does have a sense for what these soldiers are experiencing.
What does he mean, do you think, when he says, as he did as in the last comment we heard from him, the future of our country is at risk?
I think he believes that the insurgents are targeting the U.S. troops and that the U.S. troops are becoming the enemy, and that what's going on in the Middle East is there is the insurgents are uniting against the U.S., and that is not only hurting our troops on the ground, but that's creating a larger problem for the country, hurting our ability to work with other countries in the region to create peace over there, and also spurring additional terrorism. I mean, he said that there's more terrorism now than there ever was before we invaded Iraq. So in his view, the problem has been augmented and has worsened in recent months and in the last couple of years.
Again, Aaron Billings is a reporter for Roll Call covering House Democrats. What did he say about setting a deadline? There's been so much criticism of that idea and the notion that as soon as the American troops get out, the insurgency will be able to just take over the country or at least create chaos, and that the current government couldn't possibly get it together.
Well, that's exactly right. He was very firm, and probably, at least from the centrist Democratic perspective, more firm than we've heard from anyone. He pretty much said today that within 6 months he believes that our U.S. troops, all of our U.S. troops, can be brought home, and he thinks that's a realistic goal. He believes that Iraq needs to be put on notice before the mid-December elections, that the U.S. is not going to be a permanent occupying force, that it is time for them to take over for themselves. He believes right now that the insurgents are pretty much going after the U.S. forces alone, and that the problems are not getting any better but worsening. And if the U.S. leaves, then Iraq will be put in a position of having to take care of itself, and will be able to rise to the occasion.
A lot of points made in that very short soundbite we heard a moment ago. Another of them was the American public is way ahead of the Congress. Is that a reference to the current dispute about whether the administration misled the country, which polls show that the public now believes?
Well, I can't speak for Mr. Murtha, but the inference to me was that he was referring to the polling, which, as everyone has seen and you have seen, shows that the country is becoming increasingly wary of this, the direction of this war, and there are concerns that are mounting. And as you know, the president is suffering from some low poll numbers right now, record low poll numbers, and many attribute that drop in approval to his handling of the conflict, and I think that's what Mr. Murtha was addressing.
When a man like Murtha makes a statement like he did today, does that provide cover for other Democrats? Do you think we're going to be hearing more of this from the Congress?
Absolutely. I think I talked to several Democratic members today, many of them centrists, who said that he really will provide a calm for members who have been maybe reluctant at this point to speak out and to speak out forcefully, because, as you know, many of the people who have been calling for an immediate withdrawal have been of the more liberal set. You know, there's a group of about 70, 80 members in the House of Representatives who have said, we've got to get out, we've got to put a timeline in place, we cannot be there any longer. And a lot of members have been reluctant to go that far. But I had one centrist veteran member say to me that this is a watershed moment for Democrats.
All right. We will be watching that. Again, John Murtha, Democrat from Pennsylvania, moderate Vietnam veteran, calling for immediate withdrawal from Iraq. Aaron Billings, thanks a lot for being with us.
You're welcome.
Reporter for Roll Call. In a moment, President Bush and America's challenge to Asia on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Ali back with To the Point. President Bush took a hard line on North Korea today, saying it will not get the light water nuclear reactor it wants until after it gives up nuclear weapons and programs. President of South Korea said there is no fundamental disagreement between the two countries, the United States and South Korea. Mr. Bush is in Busan, South Korea, for talks on a number of issues against the background of China's growing influence in Asia. Jonathan Marcus is diplomatic correspondent for the BBC. And Jonathan, thanks very much for joining us.
Not at
all. Economic and military expansion by China seem to be getting all of the attention these days. Tell us a bit, if you will, about how China and this extraordinary growth is changing the diplomatic picture in Asia.
I think it's changing the diplomatic map really beyond all recognition. What you're seeing is an Asia where the United States emerged in the wake of the Second World War as the dominant, certainly military player and the dominant diplomatic actor, and now finding that increasingly in economic terms, China is emerging as the key player, important trading relationships between China and many of the other countries in the region. Obviously, lingering concerns about China's rising military capabilities as well in the region, so that perhaps pushes some people into America's embrace. But also, I think, concerns in the region that the Americans perhaps are not doing enough to engage, to share in other countries' concerns. The Americans have often been seen to be pressing very much their own agenda at regional meetings, a focus on terrorism, the global war against terror, and so on. And so I think many countries in the region, with this background of a rising China, are looking at Mr. Bush's trip to try and see some signs of an American re-engagement with their agenda, a sign that America is interested in listening to the views of the countries in the region and to work with them to try and manage, contain. It's hard to find the correct word to use this extraordinary emergence of China onto the international stage.
One word that apparently is being used in Washington, as reported today in the Wall Street Journal, is congagement, which is said to be a mix of containment and engagement. Does congagement sound right to you?
Well, it doesn't sound very nice. It illustrates some of the tensions. I mean, another phrase that's often used is American policy being split between panda huggers, those who wish economically to engage with China, and dragon slayers, those who are much more concerned perhaps about China's potential rise as a strategic competitor. I think what's happened and what's been quite clear in American policy over recent months and years, it's that there are clearly divisions within the United States, within policymaking circles, within the Republican Party and elsewhere on Capitol Hill. And to be fair to the Americans, there are the self-same divisions in Western Europe as well. How exactly to engage with China, how exactly to encourage China to become a responsible member of the international community, one that obeys international norms and accepted values, a country that can be useful diplomatically and play a role in helping to resolve issues like the disagreements over North Korea's nuclear program and so on. And I think as yet nobody has got the answers, and I think inevitably policy tends to contain elements of both these approaches, and the balance swings from one to the other as particular contingent or day-to-day issues and crises emerge.
One area that is said to be deliberately ambiguous is the so-called One China policy of the United States, recognizing Beijing as China, but at the same time agreeing to defend Taiwan, which China regards not as an independent nation, but as a renegade province, in the event that there should be some need to defend Taiwan. How is that One China policy seen by the rest of the world?
Well, it's a difficult matter. I mean, I think this underscores in some ways one of the great differences between Western Europe and the United States, one of the great tensions, that the United States is clearly a Pacific power also. It is a global power. America's policy towards, let's say, China's rise, towards North Korea's nuclear program, towards the whole question of Taiwan, is obviously a matter of international significance. The Europeans are, in some ways, one has to say, less concerned by the nitty-gritty of these issues. For the Europeans, they are more concerned about engaging with China as a trading partner. We've seen this debate highlighted very much, given all the rows between Washington and many of the European capitals, on the question of European arms sales to China. So far, the countries that are staunchly against selling arms to China, particularly Britain and now increasingly Germany under its new chancellor, they have held the line, but there are very strong pressures in Europe to relax those constraints and to sell weaponry to the Chinese. That, of course, goes entirely against the sort of drift of American policy and the concerns that are held in the Pentagon and elsewhere about China's strategic rise. And, of course, it bears directly on the whole question of America's ability to defend Taiwan. I don't think this is an issue that is necessarily going to come to any head in the immediate future, but nonetheless, the trajectory of China is clear. The modernization and improvement of China's military is clear. And whilst for the moment at least nobody is suggesting that this is an issue that would be resolved by force of arms, clearly the strategic picture facing the United States and Taiwan could change within a decade, say, or 15 years or so.
Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for the BBC. I know you're going to stay with us, and thanks very much for joining us today. Professor Xuesheng Zhao is executive director of the Center for China-U.S. Cooperation at the University of Denver. He's editor of the Journal of Contemporary China and author of 7 books about China. Professor Zhao, thank you very much for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
Can you tell us what the perspective on some of these issues is as far as China itself is concerned? Let's start with this question of the military buildup, said at first to have been Well, let me raise the issue that Defense Secretary Rumsfeld did, that claiming that China really has no threat. Why does it have to have a military buildup, not just one that might allow it to invade Taiwan, but that might go further than that with ballistic missiles that could reach beyond the Pacific? Let's start there, if we will. How do the Chinese see that, and why are they doing it?
China has seen it as a economically and political and also military rising power from their own perspective, that is to promote a modernized China. For that purpose, they want to have a peaceful environment internationally and regionally. To defend that peaceful environment, they want to have enough military force. From their perspective, in the last 20 years, China has focused mostly on economic modernization. For military side, their military expenses, although from Western perspective, has been growing in, double digit. But the base was very low. Their equipment has been much far behind the Western powers. And even for their own, military personnel's salary and living standard has not come up with the economic growth. So that's why they think they need to spend more money on their military modernization. In terms of missiles and the long-range capacity, from their perspective, it is mostly for defensive purpose. And because of Taiwan issue, which involving major powers like the United States, possible conflict between U.S. and China, they need to have the capacity, at least to deter a possible U.S. involvement if the war took place across Taiwan Strait.
So then the United States is very definitely the power against which the missiles would have to be used if indeed they were to be deployed. What about the prospect of China invading Taiwan?
At this point, there's possibility that would take place, but it is very unlikely from my perspective because for China, the anti-secession law they just passed in last March has not set up a timetable, and it is from their perspective they will make all effort to find a peaceful solution. From their perspective, peaceful unification, if there is a gleam of hope, they can do so. At this point, I think China really want to have to focus their effort on their domestic issues and also develop as power with good relationships with other major powers like the United States, European Union, and as also Asian neighbors. So if there is any possibility, I think they will avoid to use force.
Again,
that's my understanding.
Understand. Professor Xusheng Zhao at the University of Denver. Back to Jonathan Marcus with the BBC. To what extent is there, and I think you touched on this earlier, but is there a skepticism, not just in the United States, but in the rest of Asia, that China's intentions are really peaceful?
Well, look, China is trying very, very hard to send signals out to the region and indeed beyond that its emergence onto the world stage, that its arrival as a major power is something that it wants to do peacefully. It wants to spread the benefits as it gradually adapts its own system. And remember, we talk a lot about a modernizing China, but there are still huge parts of China that are immensely backward and poor. The difficulties facing China in the future of spreading wealth, of spreading the benefits of economic development, and indeed the political tensions that might lead to, are clearly huge issues for the future. But for the moment, China is showing and demonstrating that it really essentially wants to be spread its influence diplomatically. Of course, in commercial terms, it's developed ties really in all points of the compass in Latin America, in Africa. If you go to many African countries, you will find maternity hospitals, sports fields, all of the same Chinese design. There is an extraordinary Chinese outreach, both to win influence and to win friends, but of course, most importantly, an extraordinary quest for raw materials. I mean, China is, if you take a basket of the major raw materials in the world, from oil, corn, meat, goodness knows what, minerals and so on, China is really out on a spending spree all around the world, fueling this extraordinary economic modernization. So for the moment, I suppose China has an awful lot of difficulties and problems at home. I think the worry, I suppose, for the future is that if those difficulties became greater, you always have the risk of nationalist tendencies, more strident voices taking hold. We've seen this in the past. And that, of course, with a stronger military China in the future, might possibly precipitate some sort of crisis.
Jonathan Marcus with the BBC. Back to Professor Zhao at the University of Denver. When the president was in Japan, he made a point of saying that Taiwan was a model democracy and could be emulated or should be by the rest of the countries of Asia, and said that China had not gotten there yet, was very pointed about that. There was widespread reporting that the Chinese would be very irritated by this. How do you think they are responding?
I think China responding has been, as you said, irritated. However, I think they have been restrained so far because they can understand the Bush speech was not taught their domestic audience. And Bush, when he gets to Beijing, I think he will not make that type of, he will mention that issue, but not in the way he met in Japan. His trip to China is mostly as his people in the White House talked earlier, and will focus on economic and trade issue. I think that is Mao taught the purpose of his trip to Asian Pacific this time, to have some meeting on APEC economic summit. So the issue when he go to China would most be on economic issues. The democracy issue still will be there, but will not be emphasized as he did in Japan.
China is doing in the neighborhood of $245 billion worth of trade with the United States, and after Japan, it is the second largest lender to the United States, buying the bonds that help to finance the American deficit. To Professor Zhao, to what extent do the Chinese feel that that gives them special power over the United States?
I think the Chinese leaders are certainly aware of the economic card they have in their hand at this time. But I think they are very cautious about using that leverage against the United States because they really lead the corporation, lead U.S. market for their own economic benefit. There are a lot of problems in economic front, like when we said the currency issue, the intellectual property rights issue, the trade deficit issue. They have to work with the United States in a spirit of cooperation. So I don't see that Chinese leaders want to use that leverage against the United States at this point.
And, of course, the United States needs China. The Walmart and others of the major corporations now get an enormous amount of their goods from China, and that's one of the reasons they're able to sell them at the prices they are. Again, Professor Zhao, the Chinese must be well aware of that economic card, too.
Of course, but they should also understand that the Bush administration also facing pressure from domestic force in the United States, like the labor union and those outsourcing companies, about the problem that created by the rising of Chinese economic power.
All right. So we're going to continue this conversation about economics and the military buildup in China as President Bush tours Asia. Thanks very much to Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for the BBC. We'll be back with Professor Xuexing Zhao and others on To the Point a little later on Reporter's Notebook, The Washington Post's Bob Woodward, and the Valerie Plame case. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Norman Olney, back with To the Point. As the president tours Asia, now in South Korea at Busan for the economic conference, he is also, of course, facing the challenge from China, and that's principally what we're talking about today. On To the Point, the military and economic expansion of China as it grows into the other superpower in the world, if in fact that is its goal and that is its destiny. John Tasek is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Formerly, he was head of the China Intelligence Service at the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research during both the first Bush administration and the Clinton administration. He also has served in the U.S. Foreign Service in China and many postings there. John Tasek, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We just heard from Professor Zhao that he thinks the Chinese will be talking principally about trade. That's what the president will talk about when he gets to China. He won't raise this issue again of human rights and democracy. He didn't mention human rights. I should make that clear. But he talked about democracy, and the implication was certainly there. Do you think that's true? And will this issue sort of die out as he goes on to China?
Well, there's sort of no question that the economic, trade, financial issues are going to be at the top of his agenda. He said that. But he will not be able to get away with not addressing the democracy and human rights issue directly with the Chinese leadership, for one simple reason, that he's made the setup here with the speech in Kyoto on the 16th, and the first question that the press is going to ask him after he comes out of his meetings with Hu Jintao, Chinese President Hu Jintao, is, did you raise this issue? There's no question in my mind that he will raise it. I think he will raise it forcefully, both in private and in public. The Chinese reaction, I think, will be what Professor Zhao said, which is they're just going to ignore it.
The president is planning, as I understand it, to attend church when he goes to China.
Yeah.
So that certainly will be a very public event.
Yes.
Will all Chinese know about that? Is it something that will be widely publicized?
I don't think so. In the past, when the president has visited, he was there in February of 2002. Vice President Cheney was there in April of 2004. Both times, there was a press blackout on the presidential activities. The president's speech in February of 2002 was broadcast live without anybody, without any prior notification, and it's doubtful that very many people in China saw it. Not only is it doubtful, there was no interpretation for it, so you had to speak English in order to hear it. There's no prospect in my mind that the president's activities in China will be publicized.
If the Chinese then can get away with ignoring what the president says, and if their own people won't know what he has said, why does the president say those things? What's the constituency he's addressing?
I think he's addressing Asia for one reason. For one thing, there's no question that the Japanese are exceedingly anxious about the sudden assertiveness of China in Japan's territorial waters and in Japan's exclusive economic zone. The Chinese Navy has been a very assertive presence and has been a bit aggressive. I think Taiwan, of course, has been dispirited these last several years by the phenomenon that, well, they seem to think that the United States is sacrificing Taiwan's democracy to get China's cooperation in North Korea. And I think this was a message to Taiwan to say, please, I apologize, don't lose heart. And it's a message to the rest of Asia, because this was the setup to the APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. Who knows what it is? It's, you know, four adjectives in search of a noun here. But but it's the summit meeting in Busan, basically to say, you know, the Americans are not leaving. We have our commitments here, and we intend to stay. This will be welcome news in Asia, because frankly, I think a lot of our Asian friends and allies look at the distraction that has become Iraq, the problems in Afghanistan and elsewhere, and think that the United States is scaling back their presence in Asia. So I think the president's audience was not China so much as it was the rest of Asia.
John Tasek with the Heritage Foundation, formerly with the State Department and the Foreign Service. Michael Zelenziger is a visiting scholar at the Institute of International Studies at the University of California at Berkeley, formerly based in Tokyo as bureau chief for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He's also author of Shutting Out the Sun, an examination of modern Japan, which is going to be published next year. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Give us a sense of this from the Japanese point of view, and will they was Japan the right place for the president to make the statements that he did about democracy? Will they welcome, as John Tasek believes, this message from President Bush?
Well, both Japan and the United States have a very interesting and sometimes difficult relationship with the People's Republic of China. In both cases, there's both a question of competition as well as cooperation. We've mentioned earlier that we as Americans who want to be a hegemon but are running a tremendous deficit are very much dependent on the Japanese and the Chinese to pay our bills for us, to keep our interest rates artificially low. For Japan, China has been a great boon for a fairly stagnant economy. It's interesting that Bush would give his speech in Japan because it's a bit of revisionist history. I'm glad that John pointed out that you have to look at the context of what's also going on in Iraq. One of the key differences between Iraq and Japan is that we took over both countries. But 3 years after the war ended, and after World War II ended, we also put back into power many of the war criminals who had helped launch the industrial campaign against the United States. Whereas, of course, in Iraq, we've gotten rid of all the Ba'athists. We've said all of Saddam's people are no good, and we're trying to create a quote-unquote democracy from a whole cloth. So it's sort of revisionist history. The Japanese are very worried about China, and yet they also realize that their economic growth is very much dependent on China's rise.
So what then are the issues that the president needs to emphasize most, do you think, Michael Zelenziger, in order to, if this is the right way to put it, to keep both the Chinese and the Japanese happy?
Well, the first thing is he has to indicate some engagement. This administration has been so focused on Afghanistan and Iraq that many of the Asians believe that we've been sort of AWOL in Asia. There is always a very subtle balance that needs to be played in American policy between our need for cooperation with our Asian partners and our need for competitiveness with some of those partners. Frankly, one of the real concerns that I have is that the Japan alliance with the United States is so strong, and yet the American alliance with other nations in Asia is so weak that we may get to a point where China is becoming this incredibly integrative power across the Asian region, having strong trade, cultural, and political ties with all of Southeast Asia, even with Korea. After all, they are now the key players in whether or not we get a deal with North Korea over nuclear weapons, whereas Japan is increasingly isolated from the rest of Asia. Every time Prime Minister Koizumi goes to Yasukuni, the war shrine in Tokyo, he alienates all of his Asian neighbors. And so one of the threats to peace in the Asian region is that the U.S. and Japan both become marginal players in the heart of Asia.
Still on the line with us, Professor Zuxing Zhao at the University of Denver. And let me get back to you on this issue of the relationship between the United States and Japan and President Koizumi's visit to the shrine. All that, of course, in the leading to recollections about World War II and Japan's behavior. How is that viewed by the Chinese? And are they worried that the United States and Japan are a dangerous alliance of some kind?
Yes. Indeed, that's their concern. In fact, I think when he talked about democracy in Kyoto, itself is not as much irritating Chinese leaders as the Koizumi standing by him. Because from Chinese leaders' perspective, Koizumi has tried to not only revise history, but also try to set a confrontational role of Japan against China. So that is a very big concern of China. If the U.S. is working together with Japan and tries to help Japan to be a dominant power in Asia in competition with China, that is very dangerous for the Chinese leaders. And also from Chinese domestic, Chinese people's perspective, as you mentioned, that the history is still remembered well in China. they don't think Japanese has fast history and has start a new path working with Asian people. So in that case, they are really very concerned if U.S. is behind Japan in that road. In fact, when I was in China, in fact, 2 weeks ago, I talked to many Chinese academics and some also government officials. They all expressed that concern to me. I tried to tell them that U.S. does not want to see a conflict between China and Japan, but it's very difficult for them to understand that.
John Tasek, back to you at the Heritage Foundation,
sure.
Formerly with the State Department. Is the president taking a risk here?
No, I don't think so. I really have to. I have a completely different view of the China-Japan dynamic than Sam, than Professor Zhao does. The Chinese are pushing this Japan issue. The entire China-Japan friction was manufactured in the Politburo in Zhongnanhai. It was promoted vigorously by the Central Propaganda Department of the Communist Party in China. It was put up on every web page, well, not every web page, but it was put up on government-controlled web pages in the media in China back in December a year ago for the sole purpose, I think, of stirring up some, who knows, nationalistic sentiments. This is not something that the Japanese visited upon themselves. This is something that the Chinese manufactured, and it was clear from the demonstrations in China, the anti-Japanese demonstrations in China, to anybody that was watching, that the Chinese were officially stirring it up via their internet emails, and they were even conveying the demonstrators by bus to the various demonstration sites and providing them with rocks and bricks to throw. So the idea that the Chinese leadership is worried about the United States' support for Japan, and I think, is not right. I think the Chinese leadership knows what they're doing. I think they feel that it backfired when the Japanese sort of stood up to them, and I think that the Chinese leadership is probably rethinking its approach to the Japanese. But there's no question that that the U.S.-Japan alliance is the strongest part of Asian democracy's bulwark against totalitarian China.
Well, let me go back to Michael Zelenziger on this one at UC Berkeley. What's your take, and which side of this do you come down on?
Well, John is certainly right that the Chinese, there's a lot of social upheaval going on in China. How could there not be, in a country that's growing so quickly, where the gaps between rich and poor are growing so quickly, and where traditional communism, as it used to exist, is no longer terribly important in a country where people want to get rich? There's no question that nationalism is a bind, and going after Japan is a convenient way to create legitimacy for the central government. But that doesn't mean that Japan doesn't have its own problems, or that Japan has really dealt straightforwardly with its problems with China, with its problems with Korea, with its problems with Southeast Asia. We haven't even mentioned the fact that we like to talk about Japan as a democracy, but in fact Japan has had one-party rule for 50 years, so it's not exactly the kind of democracy we normally think of. Japan is going through a lot of its own economic doldrums right now and sees how quickly China is taking its place as the major dominant force in Asia. And therefore, its best reaction is to bind itself ever more tightly in the embrace of the United States. The Japanese still worry about how do we become a quote-unquote normal nation. This is a nation that has a large military, but still has Article 9 of its constitution, which says it should be pacifist. There's clear willingness now and clear energy now about changing the constitution to let Japan redeploy its military around the world. You know, Japan has sent troops to Iraq at the behest of the Bush administration, despite a constitution that explicitly prohibits it. So this is an ambiguity that has to be addressed. The more difficult question is whether Japan has really created the checks and balances within its own system to be an intelligent, normal nation as it moves forward and figure out its own self-interest in the world.
We have, there are a lot of things that we haven't mentioned today, a lot that we have, and many of them could take entire programs on their own. So, but I do want to change the subject once again, because I think people need an answer to this question. John Tasek, back to you. The president is going to Mongolia. He will be the first head of state of the United States ever to visit that country. Why is he going there?
Well, he's... It's unfortunate. He's only spending 4 hours, I believe, 4 to 6 hours in Mongolia. But Mongolia is a very strategically important country for the United States in one very clear sense, which is geographic. It, ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the rise of the buffer states between the between Russia and China. Mongolia has been one of the biggest buffers, if you will, that actually keeps the two, how could one put it, the two fissile cores of a nuclear bomb from touching each other. So I think that on the one hand, Mongolia is very useful to keep Russia and China apart and basically stabilize geopolitics in Central Asia. The second thing is that Mongolia is the only one of the former Soviet states, even though perhaps it wasn't officially a former Soviet state, to actually adopt a parliamentary democracy that has led, I think, to a very robust and vibrant and dynamic democracy in Asia that has not resulted in a dictatorship. All of the other Central Asian countries adopted presidential systems and quickly devolved into dictatorships. Mongolia hasn't gone that route. And finally, I think Mongolia is in a difficult position because it only has two neighbors, these giant neighbors, which both of which at one time or another have been its imperial overlords. And Mongolia is desperately seeking a third neighbor, which is to say the United States and basically anybody else that's interested.
Okay. We're almost out of time. I'm going to interrupt in the interest of that because I would just want to get back to Professor Zhao very briefly. I understand with regard to Mongolia that the United States is also establishing a situation where their military and the U.S. military will be able to work together. Is that any concern to China, or is Mongolia really not worth worrying about in a military sense?
I think China is certainly concerned about so-called U.S. encirclement of China now in Central Asia and also in other parts of Asia. But I don't see Mongolia in that case serving that purpose that much. In fact, I think one issue here is that Mongolia has supported U.S. troops in Iraq. I think that's one of the issues that China has different views from, okay. I mean, Mongolia.
All right. Well, thank you all so very much for being with us. We've raised a lot of issues, and you've all been very helpful in that regard. Professor Xuesheng Zhao at the University of Denver, John Tasek at Heritage, formerly with the State Department and the Foreign Service, Michael Zelenziger at UC Berkeley, formerly the Knight Ridder newspaper Tokyo bureau chief, and our earlier guest, Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for the BBC. Once again, thanks for being with us today. The Washington Post's Bob Woodward helped to expose Watergate, America's most infamous White House cover-up. Now, Woodward himself is being accused of covering up his own role in another White House scandal, the outing of Valerie Plame as a CIA agent and the wife of Iraq war critic Joseph Wilson. What did he know? When did he know it? What does it mean? More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Marvin Allen back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The Washington Post's star reporter Bob Woodward once called the Valerie Plame investigation disgraceful. He said there is going to be nothing to it. That was on radio and television interviews before the indictment of Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, and before Woodward revealed to his own editor that Woodward himself had learned about Valerie Plame days before Judith Miller of the New York Times. Michael Isikoff is an investigative reporter with Newsweek magazine, has been covering this one very, very thoroughly. And, Michael, as always, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Once again, a very complicated set of facts and circumstances here. I guess the first question would be this. If, in fact, Woodward learned about Valerie Plame before Judith Miller, what does that do to the special prosecutor who said Judith Miller was the first one, reporter to hear about it, and she heard about it from Libby?
Well, what he said was he was the first, Libby was the first official known to have disclosed it to a reporter, and that was
very careful
true at the time he said it.
Careful in the way he talks.
Right, right. Mm. Well, look, it's not entirely clear how this shakes out. It certainly throws a new wrinkle in. It has once again set off a sort of speculative frenzy about who is the mysterious official who provided the information to Woodward, what was his motivation, not just in doing so originally, but in coming forward after the indictment of Libby just a few weeks ago to alert the prosecutor to this. Is this the same still mysterious source who leaked to Robert Novak, or is it a different person entirely? Clearly, Libby's lawyers are going to make the most of this and will seek to depose Woodward, get full copies of the discovery under discovery of his testimony to Fitzgerald and call him as a witness at the trial. In some respects, it bolsters what's going to be the atmospherics of their argument that this was no big deal, that it was fairly common knowledge among reporters or among officials, that it was treated as mere gossip, not as some sort of politically charged leak aimed at discrediting Wilson. All that doesn't go directly to the charges against Libby, which is lying to the grand jury and to the FBI and thereby obstructing the investigation. But atmospherics count in a trial. If they can minimize the significance of this and also make much of the multiple discrepancies between what Woodward remembers, what Walter Pincus of the Washington Post remembers, what others remember, it could help Libby in his argument that whatever the differences in his grand jury testimony and others, it's merely a matter of foggy memories.
Once again, what we're talking about here is that the source that Woodward says told him in a very offhand way, without any reference to its being classified, that Valerie Plame was a CIA agent, went to the special prosecutor voluntarily and revealed that this conversation had taken place. And apparently this was very recent, just a few days ago. And just before that, Woodward finally told the editor, his boss at the Washington Post, where he's also an assistant editor, that the conversation had taken place. You were on Larry King with Woodward last night, I believe.
Not last night. This is actually from several weeks ago.
That was right, earlier. Yeah. Okay, excuse me.
Right.
I just saw the picture. Didn't hear the comments. But the question I wanted to ask was this, and I'm sure you know the answer. How does Woodward explain that he waited so long, particularly when he was being interviewed about the case and saying there was nothing to it, when he himself might well have been a party to it?
Well, he's apologized, first of all. He's acknowledged that he should have told Len Downey, the executive editor of the Washington Post, earlier. I think what he said is thinking, and it makes sense, that he makes a certain amount of sense, certainly, that he was told this in confidence as part of a confidentiality arrangements he had with his sources for the book he was working on, Plan of Attack at the time, about the making of the Iraq War. And it was material for a book, and it didn't leap out at him as being especially significant, that matter that needed to get reported into the newspaper at the time. Now, obviously, once the Plame matter blew up just a few months later, after all this happens, and there's a criminal investigation into the White House over who leaked it, I think Downey, I think has said that's the point at which one can imagine that's the point at which Downey would have said that's when I want to know these things. But I think that to some respects that's it's an internal matter within the Post. Obviously Woodward is a very prominent guy, but he certainly brings a lot to the Washington Post, a lot of major exclusives. So I don't see this as being particularly, shattering to his relationship.
There's an interesting difference, though, because Judith Miller was criticized in print by her own editor for not revealing more about her involvement in this, and she's left the paper.
Right, and that's what I say. But there's, I mean, there is a, first of all, Woodward is in a class by himself. Has broken more stories in the Washington Post and in his books than everybody. But there's been anybody else. But there's been a lot of scrutiny of this unusual arrangement he has, where he can work at the Post for his books, use the material for his books, write bestsellers, and you know, but then provide the exclusives when the books come out. Sometimes, as in cases such as this, the exclusives, you know, are arguably should not wait for the book. They should come out when they are known.
Should has an arrangement which no doubt is the subject of some envy by other people in the journalism profession. It's an extraordinarily good deal. But he also depends to a great extent on confidential sources and often doesn't reveal who told him what. Do we have any idea, based on Plan of Attack or any of his other books, who might be the likely suspects in
this case?
Well,
if you read Plan of Attack, there's a relatively small group of very senior officials who were clearly principal sources for the book, and that's why I say there's a bit of a speculative feeding frenzy going on right now, trying to narrow down. I noticed the New York Times today quoted spokesman for CIA Director Tenet former Secretary of State Powell, saying they were not the source. I think a lot of people will get those sorts of questions, but it's always hazardous to try to guess who a reporter's source is. Most often the guesses are wrong, and look at how long people guessed about Deep Throat and got it wrong.
10 seconds left. Has this changed what's called access journalism in Washington? Are people less willing to talk now than they used to be?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's gained a lot of interest. I think it's really too early to say how this is all going to shake out. We have to see what impact it has, if any, on the Libby trial.
All right, Michael Isikoff, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure enough.
Investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Today's program produced by Sharon Rembaum with Francis Anderton and Jonah King, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.